Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher.
Suddenly, the world's most infamous terrorist, Osama bin Laden, is back in the news. Against the backdrop of Israel's conflict with Hamas, young social media users have unexpectedly discovered the Al-Qaeda chief's notorious manifesto. Bin Laden's letter to America was issued in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks, and it laid out the reasons why his terror network had decided to wage jihad against the United States and against other Western societies. The timing here is strange, because bin Laden's letter has been freely available on the internet for years, and London's Guardian newspaper even hosted a copy on its website for some time. But in recent days, the letter has garnered massive new attention, with a deluge of TikTok users posting videos, commenting on it, and urging others to read it. The platform has since moved to limit the topic, and it removed the hashtag Letter to America, but not before the videos became wildly popular and garnered millions of views and likes. The whole episode is troubling, and it raises larger questions about terrorist propaganda and the role of social media in helping extreme ideas to go viral. That's what I wanted to talk about with my next guest. Colin Clark is a senior research fellow at the Supon Center, where he focuses on terrorism, international security, and geopolitics. Prior to that, he was a professor at Carnegie Mellon University and a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. Colin is one of the country's leading experts on terrorism and political violence, as well as the ways in which today's extremists are modernizing and amplifying their message. Colin, thanks so much for coming on.
Happy to be here.
All right, let's start with the letter itself. Could you walk us through this phenomenon, how it caught fire, so to speak, and sort of what the strategic effects are here?
Yeah, so a few weeks ago, this, what I would say was a kind of edited letter. I mean, it wasn't even the full bin Laden letter to America, appeared, started making the rounds on TikTok. And you had, you know, what I'll say were demographically Gen Z types that were reading this letter out loud and urging, imploring people in a way that, you know, Gen Z kids tend to do a little bit dramatically online of, you have to stop everything you are doing and read this in a quite a narcissistic fashion. But I saw this a couple of times, and they were speaking admiringly of bin Laden's letter, focusing in on the way that he criticized U.S. foreign policy and spoke about the Palestinians, which is complicated in and of itself. We can call it revisionist history. We can call it something else. But in any case, this started making the rounds. And, you know, as a former college professor, I was horrified. As an American, I was horrified. And I just think the fact that this spread so quickly the way it did, I mean, there's so many things to say about it. I think at its base, it's a complete failure of education. But there's other elements at play here, including the algorithm itself, who's promoting it, and why we don't see more critical analysis of Osama bin Laden and all of the issues going on in the Middle East.
No, and to that point, you mentioned TikTok, and I kind of want to drill down on that, because I'm curious as to what the role of TikTok is in all this. It's worth noting that since the atrocities that were carried out by Hamas against Israel on October 7th and the subsequent start of the Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip, that platform has been awash in content regarding the conflict. And that content has been overwhelmingly one-sided, with pro-Palestinian videos and texts and narratives that have significantly eclipsed pro-Israel ones. This has led to charges that the TikTok algorithm is amplifying the former over the latter. And there's been a number of leading politicians and officials that have accused the platform even of aiding the spread of pro-Hamas propaganda. But according to TikTok itself, that isn't the case. And you alluded to it, I think, in your answer, because what the company is saying is that the app's core user base, which is overwhelmingly young, media savvy, and more often than not, it's politically liberal, is simply, quote unquote, pro-Palestine. So what's the real story here? Can you unpack that?
Well, I think both things can be true. I think that the majority of Gen Z folks that are on the app very well may be pro-Palestinian. And it could also be true that the app itself is amplifying pro-Palestinian, in some cases, pro-Hamas propaganda, rhetoric, et cetera. It's just the information landscape as we head into 2024 is polluted for lack of a better term. I think it shouldn't go without saying that the app is Chinese-backed. And so if you look at China's stance on Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's pro-Palestinian more than it is pro-Israeli. So that could be part of it. The other part is, I think, specifically for users in the United States, anytime a U.S. adversary, whether it's a China or Russia, can use disinformation to further sow havoc in our country, among our population, it's a good thing, because we're tied up dealing with that while the Russians are making moves in Ukraine and elsewhere, the Chinese doing the same in the South China Sea, and we're at each other's throats fighting over what the younger generation is consuming online, which again, in many ways, it needs to be stated, very disturbing. I mean, as a college professor, we used to read Al-Qaeda propaganda. We've read bin Laden's fatwas. It's a primary source document in terrorism studies. But not once ever in all my years teaching did I ever have a student express admiration or say, have you ever thought about it from Osama bin Laden's perspective? It never happened. And, you know, there was a lot of talking the issue away of saying, well, these kids, you know, weren't alive on 9/11, which in some cases is true. But, you know, I wasn't alive during the Vietnam War, believe it or not, or the Korean War, you know, but it's about learning history. And I think we've done a fundamental disservice to our youth that some of these people are engaging with this topic for the first time on TikTok. And I think, you know, we saw this a lot when I was dealing with the rise of the far right, a lot of this during COVID, where you had viral anti-Semitic content, including Holocaust denialism. And for some kids in sixth, seventh grade, they were learning about the Holocaust for the first time through a meme. And these memes were suggesting that the numbers were inflated or it was downplaying them. And so this was the first time they're engaging with this content. And I think that's an absolute shame and a travesty and something within the U.S. education system that needs to be addressed.
That point you make about age and the lack of understanding is so important, because you're absolutely right that it gives platforms that package in neat little bundles information that the user was not alive to read, to hear, to experience. It allows them to shape that perception in a really profound way. And you see this, I think, generationally also in terrorism studies, in the context of professionals that weren't politically, they're of the age that they weren't politically aware of the attacks of September 11th. And so they're lacking some key context, right? Not to be ageist, but it's an important point. Okay, there's a larger question here as well of the role of social media and misinformation in the radicalization of populations generally. So walk us through these dynamics, since I know that that's something that you and your team watch very, very closely.
Yeah, so we spend a lot of time in, you know, kind of monitoring the information ecosystem. We'll spend time on Telegram, using burner accounts to kind of lurk, as the kids would say, and kind of watch some of the conversations that are happening. I mean, it helps you pick up on slang or colloquialisms. We looked at this very closely with white supremacists and neo-Nazis to get a sense of what they were doing. We looked at this really closely in the aftermath of January 6th to get a sense of broader far-right ecosystem and mapping some of the relationships between QAnon, Proud Boys, and all these various kind of far-right militia groups. And we continue to do so, looking at jihadist groups and state actors, right? So we kind of look all across the board. But when you have people that are still trying to figure out their stance on a topic, to say nothing of what I would call fence sitters, people that are feel strongly, you know, very strongly one way, and are maybe on the precipice of taking action, you know, this radicalization process can push people over the edge. I'll go back to, you know, I'm talking to you today from the city of Pittsburgh. On the day of the Tree of Life synagogue attack, I was living in Squirrel Hill, right down the block from where it happened. In fact, you know, someone like Robert Bowers, who spends a lot of time, he was on Gab, he was on all these other kind of fringe platforms, just consuming massive amounts of disinformation, spreading it, and for lack of a better term, radicalizing right there online without really having to engage with anybody. Seamus Hughes often talks about the online offline component of radicalization. And, you know, it's interesting to me to see how that proportion changes over time. We used to believe that it was something that took primarily occurred face to face. We're now seeing the power of the online environment of what now the government worries about are called HVEs, or homegrown violent extremists. So something we dealt with a lot of, as you know, during the rise of the Islamic State. where ISIS machine, its media machine and propaganda was pumping out loads of propaganda, disinformation, and we had attacks all over the globe. I mean, literally all over the globe. We had a lot in the West, including in North America and Europe, right? We had a rash. We had these different trends that would start to spike. So after this famous Adnani speech where he said, grab a rock, smash the infidel's head, you know, that was interpreted as use whatever means you have to carry out an attack. And we saw a rash of vehicle attacks, right? Nice, Berlin, New York City, Stockholm, you name it. And so we've done a lot of work on protecting soft targets from attacks. But these things happen. They kind of gain traction online and then they spill over into the real world. I think we're very concerned about that at the moment. Huge spike in anti-Semitic incidents throughout Europe, huge spike in Islamophobic incidents. Just over the weekend, we had three Palestinian men shot in Vermont. We've had a pro-Israeli protester murdered in Los Angeles. And throughout Europe, we've seen a number of incidents. And so there's also a concern of reciprocal radicalization, where we have each opposing side pushing their own narrative, consuming disinformation, putting it out. And it's a very, very nasty cycle that leads to real world violence.
So that's a hugely important point. And it begs the question, what's the proper response? Because some people claim that social media platforms are, even though they're here to stay, they're basically unreformable. What do you think should be done, can be done to limit the reach of the malicious messages you talked about and also of content like bin Laden's letter?
Again, I don't want to be too, you know, too hokey here, but I think fundamentally, and this is more of a long-term issue, right? We're dealing with digital natives, but if you watch, again, I'm not going to be ageist, but if you watch some of the hearings on Capitol Hill, you have octogenarian senators questioning tech chiefs, right? These are people that I'm unsure that they even use email, much less many of the apps that they're questioning people about. So it's a bit of a farce. I don't look to the tech companies to reform themselves. I'm not sure what kind of pressure we can bring to bear because there's so much money at stake and they've grown so large and so influential. You know, Elon Musk was, I think, just in Israel within the last day or two. He's one of the most powerful figures in the world. And he's also constantly engaged in highly questionable behavior, right? And he's an entity unto himself. So I don't really put any stake in the tech companies regulating themselves. It's not going to happen. I've been part of ongoing conversations throughout the years with governments, terrorism experts like myself, lawyers, et cetera, Silicon Valley, trying to grapple with this. And I just kind of throw my hands up at this point. So I think we need to educate our population, number one. Again, that's going to take a long time. We need to inoculate. We need to put out information out there. I think the Biden administration gets fairly high marks for their work in pre-bunking, right? And putting out a bunch of this information and intelligence we had about the Russians before the invasion of Ukraine. Because the Russians dabble so much in mis- and disinformation, we thought that that was a proper response. And it's worked quite well. It becomes more difficult once you get away from these, you know, kind of mainstream platforms toward the fringes, which are really unregulated by nature. You know, your Gabs, your 4chans, 8chans, these places are just toxic. And I think, honestly, they're impossible to regulate, especially when you live in a country where you do favor and promote free speech. The thing that bothers me, I guess, is that a lot of our adversaries don't grapple with these same issues because they do engage in heavy censorship. China doesn't have this issue. Russia doesn't have this issue. And I'm not saying I want to live in a society like that, but it does seem like an asymmetric advantage for those countries who can meddle in our politics. And, you know, we have a limited ability to kind of return the favor there. Part of it's a national security issue. I think we need to start thinking about it, talking about it, and looking at it like that, because there's few other industries we would let kind of stir the pot in our own country the way we do with Silicon Valley. I think they get a free pass far too often.
I think that's exactly the way to frame it, as a national security issue. And that naturally leads to the question about what we should do about TikTok. Because, as you know, that's a huge political issue here in the US. And critics of the White House have said that the Biden administration is reluctant to really, truly squeeze the platform because of the domestic costs, because the Democratic Party pulls significantly from precisely the age bracket that's the most engaged and active on the app. Meanwhile, what we're seeing in Congress is that calls to step in for the House and the Senate to step in and do something substantive to limit TikTok or even to ban it outright are getting louder. From your vantage point, sort of watching these trends and watching how this phenomenon is metastasizing, how should we think about TikTok specifically? What's the threat potential of the platform?
It's a really good question, and it's a really difficult one. And I think for me, it's one where my views are hardening and actually moving closer toward folks that are calling for some kind of a ban or limitation. It's a Trojan horse in many ways is the way I'm starting to view it. And I get the domestic politics side of it. The administration's not going to do anything, at least until after the election. So I'm not holding my breath on that front. I'd say for a start, we need some kind of, if you look at the commission that Mike Gallagher runs, right, on China, maybe that would be the natural starting point for a real deep dive investigation, bringing together the world's and country's leading experts on disinformation, on illicit actors' use of social media, on China. Bring all these folks together to study this, to debate it. Let's talk about this openly on the Hill in a critical way and come up with a common sense solution that still allows for free speech, but doesn't allow other countries to directly meddle in our own politics and stir the pot. Now, easier said than done. I get that. And I think the other aspect is we're in highly polarized times. Now, that's become something of an evergreen statement, but I do think we're in kind of fairly uncharted territory in terms of polarization and partisanship, which, you know, anybody that pays close attention to U.S. domestic politics understands, including those sitting in Beijing and Moscow. And so that's another part of the joy that they get of twisting the knife, is they know that we're limited in our ability to respond in a bipartisan manner. There's very few issues where we see across the aisle in the same way. I'm hopeful this could be one of them, but I think, you know, we need to balance security and privacy and liberty and all the things that we do cherish in this country. It's not a black and white issue. It's very, very much gray. Again, kind of why our adversaries, who are quite comfortable operating in the so-called gray zone, where we're not, they tend to kind of live in this space, meddle, muck around. And I think it's going to get even more difficult to deal with as we move toward November 2024 and the next U.S. presidential election.
Brilliant stuff as always. Colin, thanks so much for taking the time.
Happy to. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And, as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.